Christian. Have a great day. Thank you kindly, Steve. See you guys next week.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's a all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community radio. It is 9 o'clock and an interesting morning. A few changes, a lot of pre-recorded programming today. We've got Air Cascadia off today, and instead we're going to have a special hour-long edition of Flashpoints. Today it's about the future of marijuana, medicinal and recreational. At 11 on Between the Covers, right on time for Halloween, we hear a conversation with Amelia Gray, whose book Gutshot pushes against the outer limits of what humans can and will do. But first, I want to remind you that Press Watch is off today. Instead, Per Fogering hosts Fight the Empire for an hour with guest Roger Lowenstein, today talking about his new book, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. And that is coming up next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, an evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Harsha and Luz will speak about their work and experiences cultivating fierce, loving, and sustainable communities of resistance within a transnational analysis of capitalism, settler colonialism, state building, and racialized empire, and how climate change threatens to or is already compounding the forces of state and corporate violence against which they struggle. Again, that's Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, an evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Well, good morning. The show is Fight the Empire, and I'm Per Fogering, and my guest today is Roger Lowenstein, who is a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, author of several books, and the one we're going to talk about is America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. So, Roger Lowenstein, welcome to KBOO.
Per, it's great to be on the show.
Well, why don't we jump right into it? What does a central bank do? What is a central bank?
The easiest way to understand it is think about what a bank does. A bank takes savings from people in the community who have extra money and lends them out to people who need it. So instead of the, you know, extra money that rich people might have, say, just lying in their basement or something or in their yacht or wherever they would keep it, it gets to be used by people who have a need for funds. So, you know, if it works well, it's good for society. Well, just like some people have extra money and some people need extra money, banks are the same way. So a bank with extra money, extra reserves, will deposit it at the Federal Reserve. That's where banks' extra savings go. And banks that need money, in turn, they can go to the Fed and borrow it. So the system stays, you know, more or less healthy. And obviously, now and then, like we saw a few years ago, when a whole lot of banks catch some kind of contagion or made bad loans and so on and need reserves, the Fed can step in and lend those extra reserves to, you know, many banks simultaneously and keep the system from going down.
Well, speaking of hoarding money, I mean, right now it's said that this sort of jumping ahead, and we'll get to this later in more detail, is that there seems to be a lot of money that's just sitting around doing nothing. It's being hoarded for I don't know what.
Well, the Fed can loan to banks, which is what it's doing. When you read about, you know, Bernanke and now Janet Yellen, you know, buying all these, you know, bonds from banks, building up a big portfolio, they're lending money to banks, okay? But they can't make the banks lend it out to people. Mm-hmm. The banks have to want, or they have to see, you know, customers that they think are going to be good loans. People have to want to borrow. You don't really want banks to make bad loans. We've seen what happens, you know, in that sort of situation. So the Fed is saying, here it is, it's cheap money, come and get it. And it's sort of been waiting for 5, 6, 7 years for banks to say, you know, hey, here's a good opportunity, and someone to walk into that bank and say, give me a loan. You can't do everything, though. It can create the conditions, but you know, people have to want to go out and form companies and hire employees and so on, and that part of it the Fed can't do.
Well, now Europe has had central banks for quite a while. Was there any difference between the European central banks and our Federal Reserve?
Well, I mean, the biggest difference is they had them and we didn't. You know, mm-hmm. we came into the 20th century the only developed country without one, and it's just because of this long paranoia or conspiracy feeling that Americans felt about central banks and, frankly, central government. You can see it today. Half the Republican Party wants to shut down the federal government. And it was the same story back in the early 1790s. You know, first they didn't want a constitution at all. We had the Articles of Confederation because they were so scared of any kind of central tie among the states. That was and that didn't work. So we had we went to the Constitution, and Alexander Hamilton said, we need a national bank to lend money and organize the country's finances, and they did away with it. Thomas Jefferson didn't want it. James Madison didn't want it. And it didn't work, so they formed a second bank of the United States, and Andrew Jackson didn't want it. Even though the bank worked, it fulfilled a very good purpose. It paid off the country's debts. It provided a more stable currency. But for some reason, Americans, when they see government bank, it's a terrible thing. We're going back to the English king or something. We're going to be slaves of a tyrant. And they got rid of that bank. And for the next 75 years, we were without a lender of last resort, unlike all the countries, the developed nations of Europe and Japan and elsewhere. And we would have these periodic panics, money panics, depressions, because there was no government agency to step in and say, okay, you guys aren't lending. I'll be the lender of last resort.
Okay. Is there any difference between... Does it make a difference whether a central bank is owned and operated by the government or by other private banks?
Yeah, well,
is that an issue?
It was a big issue. And you got to understand that central banks weren't invented out of whole cloth the way they are today. They were all private in the beginning. Basically, Sweden had the first one, and you know, the king of Sweden turned to some bank to loan him money, and the same thing with the king of England. He turned to what became the Bank of England, but they were private, profit-making banks that loaned money to the crown, generally in times of war and so on when they needed money. Over time, they assume more and more public functions, like keeping the currency stable, making sure the government had enough gold and so on. In the United States, when the Federal Reserve was debated, there was a huge argument about to what extent it should be public or private. And when the bill was drafted by Carter Glass, who was a Southern Democratic congressman, he was a self-proclaimed racist. That was who the Southern Democrats were in that day. He was very much opposed to any kind of federal power, and he wanted to be run by private bankers. And Woodrow Wilson said, you can't do that. You know, this is the 20th century. We're going to need to have public officials, publicly appointed officials in charge. And this is a radical turn. You got to remember, in 1910, we didn't have government agencies directing all sorts of private industries. This is a very new idea in after what had been a laissez-faire 19th century. But Wilson insisted, and that's why they really came to a compromise in this country, because the Federal Reserve Board, of course, has publicly appointed public servants on the board from the 1913 Act to today. But the individual banks around it, the in this area, the Reserve Bank of San Francisco, the Reserve Bank of Kansas City, all the ones around the country, they are actually privately owned. And this was really a compromise between the country's laissez-faire traditions and the Woodrow Wilson idea that it had to be public.
So one of the things this Federal Reserve or the central bank does is move money around to where it's needed. This little sort of sidebar here, is there any connection between what is a central bank's connection with, say, with warfare? You know, like you mentioned that the Swedish, these European central banks loan money to kings, yeah, you know, for war. And, you know, it occurred to me that, the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. And it was sort of an emulation of these European banks, which may have been fine, but somehow the European central banks didn't keep them from going into one of the worst disastrous wars of all time.
No, well, it wasn't the job of the central banks to keep them from going into war, right?
Is there any relation at all, though?
There is a relation. The relation is that over time, governments have turned to their central banks for financing. Obviously, when they needed it most, and when do governments most need it? You know, very, very often it was in warfare. Napoleon said that, and they created the Bank of France in 1800, when Napoleon's armies were beginning to spread through Europe, and he said the Banque de France was important to him as his armies in the field, and it was the same way in England, financing the crown, and in this country after the Revolutionary War, you know, we had all kinds of debts, and one reason Hamilton created the first bank of the United States was to organize and allow for the paying off of those wartime debts. And the second bank came around after the War of 1812. So there's no data connection that, government spending goes up in wartime and financing is more necessary. Now, there are other reasons. You know, we saw another reason why you need a central bank. Suppose you have a recession, and a great recession like we had in 2008 and 2009, that had nothing to do with, or not much to do with war, but it had to do with, the real estate crisis and so on. So it's not the only reason we need a central bank. It's not just a little bureau of the War Department.
Well, now the Federal Reserve, it arose in response to a whole series of financial panics in this country. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we had a system. I said in the beginning of the show that banks now keep their reserves, their spare, their rainy day money in the Federal Reserve. But there was no Federal Reserve before 1913. So a bank would keep its spare cash, its reserves in its vault, or maybe in a bigger bank, in the city. Maybe a bank in Sacramento might keep its reserve money with a bank in San Francisco. And that bank would keep its reserve money in Chicago or New York. And anytime there was a panic, banks would call in all their reserves, and every bank would tighten up, and there'd be nothing to lend. And in 1907, we had a terrible banking panic, a bank run. And I don't mean the kind of what they call a bank run nowadays when people see it on their computer screens. I mean people ran down the sidewalk to be first to get their money out of the bank. And when the banks ran out of money, they started passing out scrip. Some of the banks in Oregon passed out paper money with pictures of fish on it because their assets were backed by loans to fisheries and stuff. And, people could either take that and try and circulate it or just take nothing because, they didn't have anything. And it was just an embarrassment. That there was no one. The government had no tools in its arsenal. And we had a terrible recession then. Sounds kind of familiar, I know, what we just went through. And at that point, some people, mainly on Wall Street, began to say, enough of these, because we'd been going through these every few years. We need some central agency to organize the country's finances.
So what brought about the panic of 1907? That was a big one, I guess.
That was a big one. Mm-hmm. These things, we had had a boom, we'd had a bubble. The Bank of England which had made a lot of loans, and English bankers, which had made a lot of loans to the U.S., began to get nervous, and they began to call back. And that was one of the problems. We didn't have our own regulatory agency. We were sort of a stepchild of the Bank of England. And they tightened up, and suddenly what happens when everybody's expanding on the basis of credit, when the credit goes away, there's no floor beneath.
Well, by the way, can they call back a loan? I mean, like if I lend money to somebody for 10 years, Can I all of a sudden decide after 5 years, hey, I want my money now?
No, but a lot of financing is short term. Mm-hmm. And you know, just as what I say happened to Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns in 2008, a lot of their money was short term. It rolled over every day or over every 30 days. Mm-hmm. And if a whole lot of the people who had that short term paper out said, you know, I don't think I'm rolling over this time. I think I'm going to collect. Well, those banks were out of business, mm-hmm. and or had to be sold off. And the same thing happened in 1907. The people who had been extending credit suddenly said, you know, this thing's gone on too long. I'm leaving the party. But, you know, it wasn't just 1907. I think I can drive home to listeners. Every fall, when they would need cash in the countryside to harvest the crops, pay the field hands, run the machinery. And don't forget, America back then, it was basically half of the people lived on farms or rural areas, a big part of the economy. They would need cash to, as I said, to finance the harvest. There'd be no money left in the cities. Interest rates in New York would go up to 100%. This happened every year. And so people who were familiar with the European system said, this is crazy. You need some central reservoir of credit to even it out. A man named Paul Warburg, a banker, had come over from Germany, compared the American banking system to a town where everybody had a pail of water in their backyard, but there was no central reservoir. Well, that's not very efficient to fight a fire with. You know, everybody has their own pail. You need that reservoir to direct the bulk of the reserves where they're needed, and that's what we didn't have.
Well, the farm economy then was, of course, so different from what it is now. I'm just wondering, thinking about alternatives for a farmer, what about, you know, this may seem kind of like a sidebar here. What about the Amish farmers? I mean, they were generally very prosperous, and they didn't go to banks for loans. How did they pay off their, you know, plant their crops and do all that?
I'm not an expert on the Amish, mm-hmm. but the American farmer needed credit. And mm-hmm. there's a difference, actually. If you look at Europe, they had all kinds of, they had a labor surplus. That's why so many, you know, people emigrated here. Mm-hmm. But they did a whole lot with farmhands. In the U.S., we were a spread out country. You know, there was miles and miles between one farm and the next. And we didn't have as much labor. They needed capital. Farmers needed credit. And the history of you know, the farming industry in this country has basically been one of boom and bust, depending on where they had credit or not. And there was an endemic shortage of credit and of cash in the countryside. And they, you know, that's why, you know, William Jennings Bryan in the 19th century was such a hero, because money was so tight. That's why he wanted to create, you know, something other than gold-backed money. And for him, it was silver-backed money. But it almost didn't matter what the basis was. They needed more circulating currency in the farm communities. That's why he was a hero in farm communities.
Well, so because of their economic situation, then these American farmers, they did need these infusions of credit.
Yeah, if you don't have labor, mm-hmm. you need machines. You're going to get machines. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to borrow money to pay for them. It's that simple, you know. Or you know, from the time when you plant the crops until the harvest, there's obviously no cash coming in, and someone has to finance that mm-hmm. period from April, you know, when you start tilling the soil, till, you know, whenever it is the crops get to market.
Well, maybe I'll try and check this out. I mean, how do the Amish farmers? How do they operate? I mean, they're very prosperous to this day, and they. I'm not sure exactly what kind of machinery they use. They avoid electricity and things like that, but they seem to be very prosperous.
I bet you they use plenty of capital, but
they sort of like a lending club or something like that, where they support each other. Well, they're very famous for their barn raisings. You know, they put up a barn in 2 days or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you're feeding 100 million people, mm-hmm. you know, you can't do it all with barn raisings. The farmers, the American farmer needed capital, and they needed a lot of capital.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in a way, the American farm, American agriculture has grown. It's partly based on just cheap energy, cheap oil, but that's sort of a whole other situation. But, okay, so you had this panic of 1907, and then what happened?
One of the senators, a guy named Nelson Aldrich, who was a real bastion of the conservative establishment, his daughter had married into the Rockefeller family. He had made a bundle himself with the help of his business friends. He was so powerful as a senator that he was known by the newspapers at the time as a general manager of the United States. And he's sort of a Lyndon Johnson-like figure in the Senate in his day. And he was a defender of the old system. But when he saw this panic of 1907, he began to have second thoughts. And so he traveled to Europe, and he did a study tour. And, you know, nowadays, a senator would go over and, you know, and jet over 72 hours, he'd be back. But in that era, he went over with seven or eight other congressmen, of course, in an ocean liner. They took along a Harvard professor to tutor them in the central banking systems of Europe, you know, along the way. They interviewed 40, 50 bankers in England and France and Germany, countries with robust central banking systems. Those interviews still exist, so you can see the questions that Aldrich and the other senators asked and the answers they got. And basically, they were asking the Europeans, what do you do? You know, what do your banks do when you have a panic like we just had? And the answer again and again was, well, we don't really have those kind of panics because we have a central bank that will come in and, you know, and ease the situation when things get tight. And we also don't waste reserves. The banks in the U.S. all had to keep all this reserve money in their vault, you know, in case something bad happened. And that's wasted capital. That's not out there, you know, making loans and creating jobs and everything. So Aldrich came back pretty much a convert to the European system. But he knew that he couldn't say so in public because the idea, as I said earlier, back from, you know, Andrew Jackson's day of a central bank in this country was just a third rail. You step on it and you were electrocuted politically. So he did something that, you know, this is where the story seems to have been hijacked by a Hollywood scriptwriter. He decided he was going to draft a bill for a central bank like they had in Europe, only, you know, fitting the American system. And he wanted to hire, or not hire, but recruit some people who, bankers who understood how to write this law. So he asked three top bankers from Wall Street to help him draft a bill. Only they didn't do it in Aldrich's office in Washington, and they didn't do it in his home in Rhode Island. They went on a secret mission down to an island off the coast of Georgia. They all went down in Aldrich's private rail car. They were dressed up in hunting gear, and some of them carried rifles. They had no intention of doing any duck hunting at all, but that was a ruse. It was a duck hunting trip. They put up at a private club where J.P. Morgan was a member. Morgan had, of course, the great financier of that time period. He'd cleared out the clubs and nobody else was there. They all used aliases, so even the staff wouldn't know what they were doing. And for a week, the staff, you know, fed them with wild turkey and quail and, you know, fresh oysters and everything, good stuff. And these guys sat around the table and drew up the first draft of what became the Federal Reserve Act. And that's a true story.
Okay, so they created this Federal Reserve Bank. It had to be passed by Congress.
Yes, Aldrich was, as a progressive era, we're talking about 1910, was gaining force. He was on the way out politically. And his bill was rejected because he was such a conservative figure, and that was no longer popular. However, the basics of his bill, when Wilson came, Wilson was elected, really the first progressive president. You could maybe call him the only progressive president, but Wilson was elected in 1912, and he wanted some sort of banking reform, a central bank. Wilson, by the way, was just as scared as Aldrich. When on the campaign, he said, I'm opposed to the idea of a central bank. And a banker he knew said, why'd you say that? I thought you were for it. This is in private. And Wilson said, well, I got to be elected first. You know, that was, politics was just the same then as it is now.
He also said he's opposed to the war.
Exactly. Well, I think he was. We'll get into that. But I think he was opposed to the war. But of course, that came later in his first term and into his second term. That when Wilson and Carter Glass set to creating their own bill that became the Federal Reserve Act, they really used this Aldrich bill that was drafted in Jekyll Island as a template, and much of it survived intact. It became the basis of the Federal Reserve Act, which Wilson signed at the end of his first year in 1913.
So what does the Federal Reserve actually do? It creates money. How does money come into being?
Well, the Federal Reserve holds the banking reserves, holds the reserves for individual banks. Now, let's say the Federal Reserve wants to add money into the system. It will buy securities from individual banks, you know, any of the thousands of banks around the country or dealers and recognized dealers and treasury securities, they will get a credit at the Federal Reserve, and they can turn that credit, you know, into dollar, into paper money or electronic money, you know, either one. And if the Federal Reserve decides there's too much money in circulation, it will sell notes back into the system, so that you know, it'll collect dollars from the people it's selling to, and they'll just be holding paper. So what happened, for instance, in 2009, when 2008, 2009, when the Fed wanted to create all this money into the system, it bought a ton, something like over the 2-3 year period, $4 trillion of securities. So now all those securities are on its books, and all that cash is available on the books of individual banks that could go out and lend it and revive the economy.
Well, when you buy a credit, it's like buying a loan, then, isn't it?
Yes. Money is credit. Money is credit. I mean, that's troubled some people, but if there was no credit in the economy, you know, you'd have a few rich people sitting on gold in their basement, and everybody else would be bartering. It just doesn't work very well. So that, you know, in the old days, what was money was a banknote. You know, it was called a note because it was a loan. So you'd get a loan from you know, the Chase National Bank, or a note from the Chase National Bank, and people you know, accepted as money because they knew they could take the note back to the Chase and get gold for it, or get some hard asset for it. And then the Fed Reserve came along and replaced them, and instead of the, you know, notes that said Chase on them, now we have Federal Reserve notes. And of course, for the first 20 years or so with the Federal Reserve, you could still take those Federal Reserve notes back to your local Federal Reserve bank and get gold for it. Now, if you take a Federal Reserve note back to the Fed, they'll just give you another Federal Reserve note.
Mm-hmm. Well, could a government just issue currency on its own?
Yeah, our government is issuing currency on its own. It's only, that's why the job of...
But the government, to issue currency now, then the government, they borrow money from the Fed to issue this money?
Well, yes, the Fed, when the Fed buys treasury bills, or as Bernanke did, treasury bonds, longer-term securities, it's buying a piece of paper. You know, a treasury borrowing instrument. The treasury's the U.S. government.
Like the Fed is loaning the money to the treasury.
Yes,
then.
It's accepting the treasury's paper, and the treasury's getting cash for it, and that goes into circulation. And in that sense, the Fed is created, you know, until such time as the Fed sells back that note or it expires, the Fed has created money. And that's how it happens. The Fed is loaning the government money. Now, the government can't do it without the Fed. And to the extent that the Fed is independent, you know, that's why we have an independent Fed. That's why the Fed isn't part of the Treasury. So they just can't run the printing press all day and all night in the Treasury Department as long as they want.
What about like the Bank of North Dakota? This is a state bank. How do they operate?
Well, the Bank of North Dakota...
it's the only one in the country, I believe.
Is only state bank in the country?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I think there are still a lot of state banks. They're probably part of the Federal Reserve System. You can be a state bank and be part of the Federal Reserve. This means your charter comes from the state, but you can be part of the Federal Reserve System.
Well, from what I read, they are totally, they're the only, a lot of banks that call themselves a state bank, but North Dakota really is a state bank. It's owned by the government, and they
you mean it's owned by the state?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that one. That's, you know, you're off on the fringe there. But
I know a woman named Ellen Brown has been writing a lot about this, and her articles have been appearing quite a bit lately.
Yeah,
and
I mean, the trouble with state-owned banks is then you have the government deciding who should get loans or not, and you know, in as much as possible, I'll go with the conventional wisdom that you really want the decision on who gets a loan to be based on the opinion of someone whose own personal profit depends on that loan being paid back. I mean, the way the system is supposed to work is, you know, if I'm a private banker, I'll loan you money if I think you're a good risk. And if I don't think you're a good risk, then I won't loan you money because, you know, I don't want a bad debt. And if you have a state-owned bank, that market check doesn't operate. Now, obviously, the private system doesn't always work. We've had terrible credit busts in this country. But I think you need private capital in the banking system if you're going to get anywhere.
Okay, this is Fight the Empire, and my guest is Roger Lowenstein. He's the author of America's Bank, which is a story of the epic struggle to create the Federal Reserve. Well, it was a struggle. What were the opponents saying about this?
Well, it's interesting. They were saying a lot of things that people are saying now about the Fed. They said that, if you create this thing, it'll get bigger and bigger. It's of a nature. One of them said Charles Lindbergh's father, the aviator's father, was a very vocal opponent, Minnesota congressman. He said, if you create this thing, it'll become a big monster out of control. Many people said it would be very inflationary, once there was a government bank, it would just print money willy-nilly. That really hasn't been the experience of the country. There have been a few inflationary episodes, but by and large, that has not been the experience of the Fed. They were very afraid, though, in general, of the power that a government bank could exercise. They were afraid of, having this big mass of deposits under the government purview. And they're also very afraid, something people say now, that it would become a tool of Wall Street or too close to Wall Street. And of course, that's something, that's been a concern expressed right up to the present day when big Wall Street banks, among other banks, got bailouts.
So, well, finally, Congress passed the Federal Reserve. How is it different? What has happened since then?
Well,
we could flash forward to right now, but we could take some intermediate steps here.
Yeah, there are a few intermediate steps mm-hmm. that are important. The most important is, I think, that when they created the Federal Reserve, there was a huge struggle about whether or not the power would be centralized or not. And this is the objection, central power. And so what they did was they formed a compromise. That's why we have a Reserve Bank of San Francisco, Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Reserve Bank of Atlanta, and so on around the country, mm-hmm. really mimicking the compromise in the Constitution. And we have a board in Washington, and we have the perimeter banks around. Power was shared. I think they were so afraid of offending one side or the other when they wrote the bill that they left it kind of vague where the power would lie. Would it be with the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco? Would it be with the Treasury? Would it be in the Federal Reserve Board in Washington? And because of that, when we got into the Depression, there was a great deal of uncertainty about who could exercise the power, and there was no strong, there was no one strong element in the Fed that said, I'm in charge here, I'm going to save the system, and nobody did for 10 years. Over time, power gravitated, obviously, to the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. If you compare the Fed today to the Fed in 1913 that Woodrow Wilson created, it's a much more Washington-centric organization. So when we had this, mortgage panic and banking panic in 2008, there was no question. Ben Bernanke was in control. He said, it's my decision. In the 1930s, in the Depression, some banks wanted to ease up, some banks wanted to tighten, and there was no uniform policy. In 2008, Ben Bernanke said, here's what we're doing. And of course, he adopted a very loose policy to try to re-stimulate the system. So that had changed. Another big difference between 1913 and today is when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, we still had a gold standard. So that even though the Fed was created, there were limits on the amount of money it could create because the dollars were callable for gold, and we only had so much gold. And Ben Bernanke has said before he passed power on to Janet Yellen that in theory there's no limit to the amount of credit the Fed can create today. No limit. That's a pretty strong statement because that gold check doesn't exist. We went off the gold standard partially under Roosevelt and the New Deal and finally and fully under Nixon in 1971. So now the Fed has much more responsibility because in the early years, it was partly just a factor of how much gold there was that determined how much money could be created. Now it's all up to the Fed. So, they have a heck of a lot of discretion, which is why Janet Yellen's job is not an easy one.
So basically, that's where the power resides in the Washington Fed, or
that's where the power mm-hmm. in the Federal Reserve Board.
Even though in theory they're kind of like the Pope is actually just the Bishop of Rome, but somehow he's got a lot more power than all the other bishops.
Yeah, the bishop in Washington has become you know, by far stronger, and there's a move to make Washington stronger still. I question that. You know, I come from Boston. I live in Boston, and each of the Federal Reserve banks has a its own board, and so I know the guys. Some of them on the Reserve Bank in Boston, and one of them owns a restaurant chain called Legal Seafoods, very popular out in Boston. And so he goes down to the Federal Reserve Bank in Boston. He tells them what wage pressures are like in his restaurants. And when this Boston bank president goes down to Washington, he has that knowledge to tell them what labor conditions are like in his area. And so does the bank president in Dallas and Atlanta and, you know, around the country. And I think it's very healthy for the people in Washington, for the Reserve Board in Washington, to be getting this input when they try to make decisions.
Well, one thing that happened in the... Well, it was back in the 30s was the Glass-Steagall Act was passed. Of course, part of that was Carter-Glass.
Carter-Glass.
Okay.
Yes.
And that what that did is that separated investment banking from the banking we started out talking about.
That's right. So Carter-Glass, who was the father of the Federal Reserve Act, he was a son of a Civil War veteran, grew up under Reconstruction in Virginia, and the Federal Reserve Act was his first big legislation, and Glass-Steagall, he's probably better known for that today because it's got his name on it, was passed in 1933. And that separated banks from investment banks and also brought in deposit insurance. And the idea was, if we're going to have deposit insurance, if the government's going to insure the deposits that are in banks, we don't want banks doing risky things, you know, with that deposit money. That law was gradually dismantled and then fully dismantled in the 1990s in the Clinton administration, with the full support of the Clinton administration. A lot of people have blamed that dismantling for what happened then in the next 10 years when we had the mortgage crisis. The evidence really isn't that clear, though. If you look at banks, for instance, that just did regular banking, you know, just issued mortgages such as Countrywide out here in the West Coast, you know, they had all the problems and worse of the banks that did investment banking. So the best evidence that the reason we had this mortgage crash in 2008 wasn't because of investment banking. It was because of old-fashioned banking done poorly. They were just making bad loans, and they made many, 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 many bad loans. I'm not sure Glass-Steagall had as much to do with it as people think, people say.
Well, a lot of these bad loans were kind of sold. who was it who made these bad loans and then sold them off? They diced them and sliced them. And
Countrywide would, or Washington Mutual out here on the, you know, Pacific Northwest would, and of course they expanded over the country, but they would make these loans, and then they'd sell them in some either to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or to a private third party that would, as you say, slice them and dice them, package them into securities and to investors around the world.
And I remember one year when I used to read The Nation, and the back page and the classified ads in The Nation magazine, there'd be a little thing about mortgage funds or something like that where you could invest in this and buy a piece of this action.
Yeah, and it was a terrible example of market speculation going awry, and the whole idea. Angela Mozilla, who ran Countrywide, was going around saying that people should get 100% of the value of their house that big a loan. I mean, obviously, you know, if they loan you the whole purchase price, you have no investment, and you're not going to think twice about walking away from it. And then, you know, even then to see how good the security was, they started accepting so-called stated loans, where instead of proving that you had a certain income and certain assets to justify for the loan, it was so-called stated. You would just state it, and then take it on faith. And, you know, I don't know why people were surprised that so many of these loans went bad, and the bankers were responsible, the securities firms that acquired them and sliced them and resold them were responsible, and the end investors were responsible too. That, you know, people were stupid up and down the line.
So okay, in the the latest crisis, which I think is still going on, but they put more money into the system, which is what the Fed, this Bernanke and the Fed
right.
did,
right?
And what this did basically added to the debt. I mean, there is a debt. I'm not sure what it. What is it? Is there any agreement as to what the total amount of debt is now, or is this a matter of contention? Because,
you know, the debt as a percentage of the GDP, the government debt as a percentage is running about 3% right now. Mm-hmm. Wait, you know, it was up around 10% at the height of the crisis, pretty high, but now it's around 3, which is thoroughly manageable. It's not. You know, countries in Europe have gotten into far more trouble by saying we have too much debt. Let's have austerity. Let's stop spending. And, you know, they're still all of them on the border of recession, you know, maybe a little one side, maybe a little the other side. But if you want to pay off debt, much better to get your economy growing, have people with jobs, have those tax receipts flowing in. That's the way you take care of debt. And that's the way we've been doing it. You know, if you start trying to shut everybody down, boy, you'll have debt for a long time. We learned this supposedly in the Depression. You know, we were coming out of the Depression in 1937. The economy had grown quite a bit from the bottom in 1933. Unemployment had gone down from about 25% to about 10, 11%. Still pretty high, but way lower. And Congress said, okay, things are better. They put an austerity budget on. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates, and it was too soon. We went right back into just a severe, severe recession that we didn't come out of until World War II.
How much growth do you think it would take to to keep repaying these loans when they come due? I mean, paying off this debt, you say it's manageable. It requires a certain amount of growth in the economy, doesn't it?
Well, it's more a matter of if the growth is higher, it'll be paid off sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And, if the growth is lower, it'll take longer. But it's not as if the goal is to get to a point where we have no debt. It's healthy to have some debt. If you said we're going to, put this country on a starvation diet so nobody has any debt, you'd have the worst recession you ever saw. Somehow credit gets a bad name with people, but credit is a way by which people who have extra assets loan them to people who have a need of assets, and therefore the assets of the country in one way or another are used productively. It's a very healthy part of the economy.
Well, it's still part of it growing. If the economy doesn't grow at all, it would seem debts don't get paid.
Yeah, but it is growing. You know, it's been growing for 200 years. So, I'm not a pessimist on this country.
Well, it's growing less now than it was different time at different periods.
Yeah. Some periods are slower. Some periods are faster. But if you want to make sure that it grows really slow, put this country, put the Federal Reserve on a starvation diet and see what happens.
Well, what about, there are people who think that, they say that growth is basically based on cheap energy. Energy is what increases productivity, and growth comes out of productivity. If you don't have productivity, you don't have much growth. And so this productivity is based on cheap oil. At the first oil well in Pennsylvania, they struck oil at 69 feet. Now they drill, under the ocean horizontally, and they do the fracking and all that. And oil has gotten, it went so expensive, it got up to $147 a barrel, and then it crashed. Then it went back up to about, $120 a barrel. It crashed again. Now it's down to about $45 a barrel. And what happens is that the fracking, you're in a situation now where in North Dakota, they need a certain price level to make it profitable, but the economy can't afford that price level.
Yeah, well, that just means there's a lot of oil out there,
But they can't use it because it costs too much to drill. Also, there are all these environmental, climate limitations. Also, that's another.
I think we're getting away from banking here. But
well, that's true. Tells me that banking, it exists in this world. It exists in a bigger world, and it's trying to cope with that world. The only way it knows how. but somehow this things are happening in the larger world that might undercut the banking system.
Well, it doesn't undercut it. It demonstrates a use of the banking system. You know, if oil drillers are having enough time, tough time, they're going to need credit. If it's a flush time, you know, then in effect, through the banks, through capital intermediaries, they'll be lending to other industries, which, you know, which may then be short and so on. That's how the system works. I mean,
well, it's not working in North Dakota. The banks are not lending these drillers money because they don't expect to get it paid back. And so
everybody's not always going to be flush at once.
Well, these drillers are going out of business. Yeah. Well, you know, the rig count is down, and apparently this shale boom did not last very long for reasons of geology.
Yeah. Well, the Federal Reserve can't do much about geology.
That's true.
It can do a lot, but it can't change geology.
That is true. I'm just wondering, the banks cannot change geology. Can geology change the banking system?
Well, I don't think it has. I mean, they have to be careful about making...
We're speculating here. Yeah. We're talking about the future. You know? Well, I mean, it's just... what would happen? I mean, with little or no growth, it makes it harder to pay back loans. And so, the banker can extend the loan. He can, you know, they can take their ways of making it work. Is there a kind of a tipping point or kind of a critical point where
what's important about bank loans and this is that they be based on the ability of the borrower to repay. Mm-hmm. And this is where the Federal Reserve should be criticized, I think, in the recent past. And obviously every bank is going to make some mistakes. That's why they call it a risk. You know, somebody walks in, they have an idea for a business or expanding a business, they want a loan, and he or she looks like a good risk. And, you know, sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't, and the banker's got to use their best judgment. In the early years of the 2000s, probably a majority of the banks of the country made risks that were really foolish on their face. You know, you give somebody 100% of the value of their house, that's leaving no margin for error. And if you give them, if the value of their house has gone up, you know, 10% a year for the last 5 years, then you're giving 100% of an inflated value. And that's not what used to be called a businessman's risk. That's a wild, speculative Atlantic City or Las Vegas risk. And the mistake of the Federal Reserve wasn't coming in and saving the system when it crashed. That was necessary. The mistake was not cracking down on these foolish speculative banking practices while they were going on in 2002, 2003, 2004, and so on. And so we would, you know, to prevent us from having such a terrible bubble. And that's, you know, that's a black mark on the Fed.
Well, how do you think the Fed is doing right now? How would you rate it?
I think the Fed is doing reasonably well right now. We have a growing economy, not growing as fast as people would like, but if you look around the world, we're growing faster than just about any other major economy. And that, you know, it's hard to do because if orders aren't coming in from China or Europe or, you know, wherever, you can't be the lone guy out there speeding along. The rest of the world will drag you back or drag you forward. But we are going faster than they are. The value of the dollar is very high in world markets. So, you know, people say Bernanke and Yellen are, you know, inflating the dollar, ruining the value of it. Well, apparently not. Everybody wants dollars. The purchasing power of the dollar is held up very well. Again, they say the Fed's creating inflation, but the rate of inflation is 2% at most. So the value of the dollar is holding up. The employment rate is down to, 5.1%. I know a lot of people aren't happy with the jobs they have, but that was also true 5 years ago when the employment rate was 10.3%. So the progress, the motion is in the right direction. Relative to the rest of the world, we're doing very well. And relative to where we were 5 years ago, you know, we're doing very well. So again, the Fed's not a magician. It can't wave a wand and say, you know, I want the economy to improve. But given its powers, given where the rest of the world is today, given where we were 6-7 years ago, I think it's doing very well.
Well, they're waiting for Janet Yellen to drop the shoe.
They're waiting for Janet Yellen to drop the shoe, and she will have to drop it.
At sometime at the end of the, before the end of the year, well, she says.
There is not a whole lot of window between between now and the end of the year, and if she doesn't do it soon, she gets into a real tricky stretch because we go into the election season, and you'd rather not have the Fed be making these decisions in the thick of an election. The decisions then come to be or come to seem political. You don't want their decisions favoring one party or another party. You'd just rather have that separate. So, you know.
But we're always in election season now. They sort of perpetual.
Well, that's true also. That's true also.
So, well, now, from the panic of 1907, that was partly caused when the banks and Bank of England raised its rates.
Correct.
And so could something like, suppose the Fed raises its rates here. Means that all this, I guess, now does that affect existing loans? They still operate under the terms of the loan, right? In other words, if you take out a loan.
What the Fed controls is short-term interest rates. Mm-hmm. So that's an important distinction. Mm-hmm. It's really the overnight rate, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's the rate at which banks lend to each other overnight. But what tends to happen is that rate affects other rates. If you have a mortgage, if it's a fixed mortgage, you know, you're going to pay the same rate no matter what Janet Yellen does. Of course, many people now don't have fixed rate mortgages. Mm-hmm. They have variable mortgages. Mm-hmm. And usually those rates will adjust each year according to some short-term rate. Mm-hmm. So by one means or another, when they raise short-term, and they can only raise now because they're at zero, so they can't go down further. When they adjust short-term rates, it's going to move, that effect will move through the economy. It'll change the rate that people end up paying on mortgages, on car loans, you know, consumer loans, business loans. I mean, it'll have an effect. But, you know, you ask, well, will this cause another panic? You know, we're at zero now, so we got plenty of room to go to. And the idea of people who think the rate should go up is money shouldn't be free, and when it's free, that causes distortions. People, you know, borrow too much, or they do foolish things, speculative things, maybe buy real estate or whatever. And
they call it a carry trade or something.
Yeah, the carry trade, exactly. So at some point, you know, money should have a real price on it, and I think Janet Yellen realizes that, and that's why she said she's going to have to raise.
And that. Would that kill the economy then, or would that?
No, I think, you know, we've had a booming economy with rates at 3%, 4%, 6%. There's nothing magic about zero. It's probably unhealthy to have them at zero for too long. People forget how this country survived for 200 years with the positive interest rates at a positive number. They don't have to be zero. That's not a requirement for a healthy economy.
Well, now there's also talk of negative interest. I mean, in the Bank of Cyprus, didn't they have negative interest? Are they? How did that work?
Well, that works when people are so afraid that they're about the security of their money that they're willing to give it to a bank, you know, say give $100 to a bank, and are willing to get back only $99 and 80 cents or something, just for the security of getting it. So instead of getting $100 plus something, positive interest, they're getting negative interest, and that happens when people expect that there's going to be deflation. You know, prices going down, so that $99 you're getting back is actually worth more. You know, in a year or two, because prices have gone down, and you get into that, and you get into a very negative spiral. Just the same way when you have inflation, people rush to spend before prices go up. When you get deflation, people hold back spending because they say, "Why should I spend? It'll be cheaper next year." And then it becomes a vicious cycle. Nobody spends, so retailers and so on drop their prices, and so people hold back spending more, and pretty soon the economy comes to a dead halt. And that's why the Fed is working hard to create some inflation so we don't get into the negative territory.
Okay, so you give the Fed then a pretty good report card, and
I give the Fed a pretty good report after it realized that we had a crisis, and in the period it's worked to get us out of the crisis, and get the economy going again. I think it does not get a good grade for me in the years leading up to the crisis.
Okay, well, you've written this book. Do you have any more books in the future that you're working on, or what?
Yeah, I expect to. I'm not quite ready to talk about those, but you know, this was a history about how we came to get the Fed, how the American body politic was so frightened of national banks, big government agencies, that it took on a, you know, sort of paranoid fear of having this agency, and how a band of crusaders and reformers fought this and educated and enlightened the public. And I think we're fighting the same tendency in Washington today, where people are so afraid of the federal government. And I think what these reformers did in creating a bank very much along the lines of the Constitution, a wonderful compromise, is a model that people could learn from today.
Well, do you think the economy will keep growing? Well, right now it's growing at a very slow rate. Do you think it'll grow at a faster rate in the future? What do you think is happening in Europe? Any ideas about that?
Europe is working very hard and really struggling because they have not had as aggressive a central bank as ours. And Europe could learn a lot from the Federal Reserve.
In other words, austerity is...
I told you, you want austerity, you'll get the mother of all recessions.
Okay. Well, I just sort of wonder if growth, you know, there are people who say that the economy, that growth is kind of a, if you look at the biggest picture of all, growth is sort of peaking, is coming to an end, and that that'll change everything.
Yeah. I heard that growth is coming to an end in the 70s, too. Mm-hmm. Garages up and down the West Coast and the East Coast filled with kids inventing new companies. I just don't believe that growth is coming to an end stuff.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Roger Lowenstein, who is the author of America's Bank. He's a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And this book tells about how the U.S. Federal Reserve was created and all the political maneuvering and...
machinations and conspiracies that went into it.
Whatever. Well, yes. All the planning and that chapter about Jekyll Island, you know, the train, the sealed train that went down to Jekyll Island.
People will enjoy that one.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Pear, it was a pleasure to be talking to you.
And stay tuned. This has been Fight the Empire, and we have a few minutes left before the next show comes on, but stay tuned. There's always something good on KBOO, your radio station.
Yes, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Coming up in 1 hour, join us for Between the Covers, which is right on time for Halloween, all about a conversation with Amelia Gray, whose book Gutshot pushes against outer limits of what humans can and will do. But before that, Air Cascadia is off today, and instead we'll go to a special hour-long edition of Flashpoints on the future of marijuana, medicinal and recreational. That's all coming up in just a couple minutes here on KBOO. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your support. Not a member? Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio, along with the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee and the Jericho Movement, is a proud co-sponsor of Decolonization and Political Prisoners, Thursday, October 29th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Portland State University Native American Community Center. The evening will focus on U.S.-held political prisoners and decolonizing the prison industrial complex. Speakers include Chauncey Peltier, son of Leonard Peltier, Kent Ford, founder of Portland Black Panther Party, and father of Patrice Lumumba Ford, and Ajamu Umi of the Portland chapter of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Again, that's Decolonization and Political Prisoners, Thursday, October 29th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Portland State University Native American Community Center, located at 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge, secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons, it bankrupts schools, and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO news director, Jenka Soderberg, in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. And more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Special edition of Flashpoints, the future of marijuana, medicinal and recreational. We'll feature some of the leading experts on all aspects of the use of cannabis, including breakthroughs in its healing powers, the use of CBDs, the importance of organic cultivation, knowing what you're buying when you head out for your local dispensary, and the current and future legal issues that will naturally follow legalization. I'm Miguel Gavilan Molina, with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Miguel Gavilan.